Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. One of my first assignments as a science journalist while pursuing a degree in the geosciences was to write a series of articles for McGill University in Toronto, Canada. I remember two of them in particular were about transform faults and the San Andreas Fault. Looking back at my level of understanding then as compared to now, all I can say is that if the articles were any good at all, it might have just been a happy accident. But plate tectonics and the San Andreas Fault have fascinated me for decades, ever since growing up by the famous transform boundary in Southern California, crossing it constantly on trips with my father up Highway 14 on our way to horse shows or visits to friends and family in Bishop, California. In the late 1990s, I started seeing articles about the idea that the Gulf of California may continue its divergent separation of Baja from mainland Mexico, and that that process could even continue up through the Death Valley region and into eastern California. Recently, I started hearing about a version of this idea with more frequency that had a name, the Walker Lane Hypothesis. So when I saw an article by Jeff Manaw in Wired magazine about the Walker Lane featuring Jim Falds, a leading proponent of the theory and a geologist for the Nevada Bureau of Mines and Geology, I decided to reach out and invite him to join us here on the dot. He eagerly agreed and joins us now. Jim Falds, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics. Give me your elevator speech version of, you know, what is the Walker Lane that I've been hearing so much about the last couple of years?
Sure. So the Walker Lane hypothesis basically proposes that a system of what are now disorganized faults in Eastern California and Western Nevada may one day become the primary plate boundary. Kind of replacing the San Andreas Fault as the primary boundary between the Pacific and North American plates.
Describe the setting for us exactly where this is. Where is the Walker Lane? Tell us about the geographic setting of it and some of the tectonics about what kind of geology is going on there, just briefly.
Yeah, sure. So the Walker Lane, and I should preface this with the southern part of the Walker Lane is commonly called the Eastern California Shear Zone. So maybe I'll start there. The Eastern California Shear Zone and Walker Lane start in the Mojave Desert region down around Victorville, just north of Victorville in Southern California. And then it extends kind of north up the east side of the Sierras, kind of the western part of the Great Basin, up through Eastern California, up through the Bishop area, up through Death Valley. And then it sort of jogs to the east a bit into Nevada, into west central Nevada near a town called Hawthorne. And then it extends up through western Nevada, just east of Reno. And then it enters back into California up around Susanville and kind of ends up in northeast California, kind of in a diffuse area around Alturas, California, that area up there. And the tectonics are, it's a system of, today anyways, disorganized faults, but we know that it actually accommodates around 20% of the plate motion between the Pacific and North American plates. And so most of the faults in the Walker Lane, they're called strike slip faults, and you can stand on one side of the fault, and on the other side, if you will, the crust would be moving to the right relative to where you're standing. And the same thing, if you stand on the opposite side, that other side of the fault would be moving to the right, whatever side you stand on. And that's the same relative motion that the San Andreas accommodates. It's just much less of the motion than the actual San Andreas accommodates.
So you know, in a big picture version of this, if you're on the Nevada or the North American side looking west, that western side is moving to your north.
That's correct. Absolutely. Yep. And it's moving to the north on the order of about, across the Walker Lane, about 1 centimeter per year, about a half inch or so. Whereas the San Andreas is accommodating 4 times that amount of movement, about 4 centimeters per year.
Yeah, and over time, that 4 centimeters, that adds up, and which is why we have earthquakes.
That's right. Yep, it adds up, and over a very long term, it adds up to hundreds of miles of offset, for example, across the San Andreas. Over the term, though, of a couple hundred years, it still adds up to several feet of offset. And the interesting thing about faults is that's commonly where the crust is kind of locked up, where it doesn't actually move until it ruptures in a major earthquake, whereas the plates keep moving outward of those faults. So the North American plate and the Pacific plate are always moving, but they're kind of locked up along the faults, where that's where they come together. And then, of course, they rupture periodically in major earthquakes.
Well, let's go back historically here. You know, because the idea that the San Andreas Fault is a plate boundary is really not that old, you know, if you look back at the history of this. So, like, you know, if we go back to 1906, for example, and the great earthquake of San Francisco, which is kind of when they discovered the fault, you know, it had kind of been known as a landform, but, you know, they weren't sure what it was. And then they, you know, Andrew Lawson and Grove Carl Gilbert and those geologists back then, you know, mapped the offsets on the fault there from, up around Shelter Cove all the way to San Juan Bautista during that big earthquake. And I remember there were some, you know, offsets that were like 20 feet. But at that time, they really, you know, it was a revolutionary idea that faults were moving laterally at all, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was. And it's difficult to understand that lateral motion unless you really have a lot of mileage under your belt in terms of understanding the geology on each side of the fault. So we go back 100 years or so in time, and even though we were having major earthquakes, it was hard to imagine at that time that those earthquakes had been occurring for long periods of time along individual faults and actually accommodating maybe tens of miles or hundreds of miles of offset, because it took quite a while to accumulate kind of the geologic information on either side of the fault to know, you know, how things matched, how the geology and the rocks and so on matched across the faults. So, yeah, we go back to the 1906 earthquake, and at that time, there was not a clear understanding of how important the San Andreas was.
So then, you know, let's fast forward to, you know, at about that same time, you know, Alfred Wegener comes up with this idea of continental drift, which was, you know, to put it mildly, poo-pooed by the geologic community. And it wasn't until, you know, decades later that the idea of the moving continents and the new theory we call plate tectonics emerged. And then I believe it was Jetuza Wilson, the Canadian geologist, I believe he was, that, you know, proposed this idea that this was a major boundary between two of the Earth's tectonic plates, the San Andreas Fault. So I'm wondering, you know, as we talk about this Walker Lane hypothesis, can you give us an idea of how the San Andreas Fault evolved over geologic time? Give us kind of, you know, the lifespan of that plate boundary and how it has sidestepped, as I understand, to the east, hasn't it?
Yeah, it sure has through time. And so the San Andreas, the birth of the San Andreas occurs about 30 million years ago when the Pacific plate comes into contact with the North American plate. And prior to that, there was an intervening plate, and the relative motion was sort of head-on, if you will, between converging between the North American plate and that intervening plate. But that intervening plate was slowly disappearing through time, and about 30 million years ago, the San Andreas comes into contact with North America. The Pacific plate comes into contact with North America, and the relative motions between Pacific plate and North America then is this right lateral motion, the side-by-side motion. And so that's the birth of the San Andreas. And then more and more of that intervening plate is disappearing through time, kind of in what we call it's being subducted under North America. It's going under North America and no longer present at the surface. And so more and more of the Pacific plate is coming into contact with North America starting at 30 million years ago. So the San Andreas starts growing. San Andreas starts growing to the north, and it starts growing to the south. It actually begins life, if you will, off the coast of Southern California. And then it starts growing northward and southward through time. And the interesting, one of the many interesting things about the San Andreas and that and this plate boundary is through time, it tends to jump or leap or whatever is the best verb to the east and sort of cleave off a little portion of North America, transfer to the Pacific plate. But so, and that happened originally, the entire San Andreas is just off the coast. And as it grows through time, it starts sort of moving inland. And the big jump occurred starting around 12 million years ago up to about 6 million years ago, was the southern part of the San Andreas jumps into the Gulf of California, or what is today the Gulf of California.
And let's talk about the Gulf of California, because I don't know if many of our listeners realize that that's an area that's, you know, actively spreading apart, right? And can you tell us about how the San Andreas it intersects that spreading area, which is like, you know, like a mid-ocean ridge where there's a divergence where the crust is splitting apart. How does the San Andreas fit in there?
Yeah, you can think of the Gulf of California as essentially being the southern part of the San Andreas Fault. You're absolutely right. There's spreading segments in the Gulf of California, but they're actually really short. And the bulk of the length of the Gulf of California is actually the right lateral San Andreas Fault. So you have a long sort of linear fault underneath the Gulf of California, and then a small spreading segment, and that links to another long segment of the essentially the San Andreas Fault. So there are spreading centers in there, but they're between much longer segments of the San Andreas, and so that's essentially the Gulf of California. Why exactly the southern part? Let me back up. There used to be a fault off the coast of Baja, the western coast, and that's called the Tasco-Abreojos Fault. And that basically quit accommodating most of the plate motion starting around 12 million years ago. It took time. It was several million years for this whole thing to evolve. But for some reason, the southern San Andreas sort of jumped into the Gulf of California. We don't really know exactly why that happened. There are some theories about it that I could expound on if you would like.
Well, briefly, yeah, because it's interesting to me. You know, I always thought of the San Andreas Fault as just starting at the Salton Sea, but you say it extends, you know, it really extends into the Gulf of California.
Yeah, it really goes underneath the Gulf of California, and then just with small little spreading segments connecting much longer segments of what is essentially the San Andreas. And again, there's a lot of theories as to why this may have happened. One theory is that there's an old chain of volcanoes in that area, and that made the crust weaker and softer. And then for some reason, it was mechanically easier for the two plates to move side by side and relative to one another, taking advantage of that weakness in the crust that then ultimately opened up the Gulf of California.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the Walker Lane hypothesis that a new plate boundary may be forming in Eastern California. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our examination of the Walker Lane geologic boundary with the Nevada Bureau of Mines and Geology's expert on the hypothesis, Jim Falds. I want to know the origin story for this idea. How and when did we start to figure out that not all of the plate motion was on the San Andreas Fault? And what's the origin story for the Walker Lane hypothesis? When did this start?
Well, we recognize the Walker Lane starting back in about the 1930s. And it was first recognized as an area of kind of unusual topography compared to the rest of Nevada and surrounding regions. Most of Nevada, you have these kind of northerly trending mountain ranges, and you come into the Walker Lane, and kind of the topography is discombobulated. There's a lot of mountain ranges with different trends and so on. And so that was the first recognition of it. And then that evolved into a little bit more work, and geologists began to realize that the faults within the Walker Lane were kind of similar to the San Andreas, but just much shorter, not nearly as long or as extensive, meaning that the faults in the Walker Lane were accommodating this right lateral motion. They began to recognize offsets across those faults. And then in 1932, there's a major earthquake in western Nevada called the Cedar Mountain Earthquake. And geologists went out and studied that extensively, of course, and realized that much of the offset was this right lateral offset. And so that started building, but that's kind of where things stood for several decades, that this was recognized as some right lateral faults, much smaller in size, but and much less significance than the San Andreas. But the connection to it being part of the plate boundary started to evolve, let's say, in the 1980s, 1990s. And that's thanks to new technology, what's called geodesy and GPS stations. So you have stations on the ground communicating with satellites and sort of tracking motions. Initially, it was kind of at the scale of centimeters, and now it's down to millimeters that they can measure. And they begin to recognize that this system of somewhat disorganized faults was actually pretty significant and taking up about 20% or so of that plate motion. And we probably were in full recognition of that by about the mid to late 90s, somewhere in there.
And one of the things I find interesting about this is, because the San Andreas Fault has always fascinated me, is the fault, the big fault, comes up east of Los Angeles, and then just north of Los Angeles, it makes this weird bend called the Big Bend. And that's where you see those big mountains, the transverse ranges, and they are there because of the plate motions, from my understanding, that, you know, there's just a lot of compression going on there, and that's why the fault's bent. My understanding is the crust, the plates are trying to, you know, make up for that by saying, well, it's easier to route to the east. Is that kind of how things look?
Yeah, that's definitely how what we're thinking. And if we can sort of think of the San Andreas as originally, and I'm oversimplifying somewhat, but San Andreas is initially being this kind of long linear fault, more or less on the coast or just barely inland of the coast of California and Baja California. And then that southern leg, that southern segment, jumps into the Gulf of California, moves eastward, and all of a sudden then we have this big bend, okay, in the San Andreas in Southern California. And like you say, that's led to the uplift of the transverse ranges. And that's where the two plates now are more or less colliding with one another. And it's hard, we presume it's then more difficult for them to move side by side, although they still do that in some major earthquakes. But if we go back to the Gulf of California, a much more direct path for the San Andreas would be to come up the east side of the Sierra Nevada and up through Eastern California and Western Nevada. And it's no coincidence that this whole Walker Lane belt starts to form about the same time that the southern part of the San Andreas shifts eastward into the Gulf of California.
And it seems to me, as I think about this, you know, the geography of it, that Death Valley is kind of off there to the east a bit, which is one of the lowest places in North America, obviously. How does that fit into all this? Does it?
Yeah, it sure does. And the Death Valley is essentially more or less fully within this belt, Walker Lane, Eastern California shear zone. And it's where the crust is both moving laterally side by side, but also being stretched apart. And similar to the Imperial Valley, Salton Trough, and Southern California, at least in a broad way. Yes, that fact that we have the lowest point in North America in the Death Valley, and it's directly associated, of course, with this crust, these crustal motions across the area.
Well, one of my favorite drives in all of California is to go on Highway 395, either north or south, and that kind of follows this Walker Lane region. So I'd like you to maybe kind of take us on a, together we could go on a little tour of, you know, the fascinating geology and the features, because they're so dramatic. Because, you know, like you just said, you have this very low point, Death Valley, and then, you know, not far away, the highest point in the Sierra Nevada, Mount Whitney. So let's start at that East Sierra shear zone. And just recently we had the earthquakes in Ridgecrest. And when you first heard about those, did that send off any, you know, kind of little aha, you know, this is the Walker Lane, you know, this is the incipient fault kind of thing going on. Did that fit into this hypothesis for you?
Yeah, and very definitely. And of course, this incipient fault is millions of years old. Okay, so it wasn't a surprise that the earthquakes occurred in the Ridgecrest area. But the fact that they did, and that there's been several other major earthquakes in this belt going back the last few decades, was just another wake up call that we definitely, you know, at least I live in along this zone, and it's part of the plate boundary, and that we periodically can expect major earthquakes like that. So, yeah, so the Ridgecrest earthquake was very much, a notice that this Walker Lane zone is active. It's not quite as active as the San Andreas. But we know that historically and through geologic time, it has produced a number of major earthquakes, similar to what happened in Ridgecrest in July.
And how about that? There's also a volcanic field down there in that region, the Coso volcanic range, which is considered to be, you know, one of the more active volcanic parts of California. Is it part of that kind of volcanic softening up that you're talking about?
Yes and no. The big softening up, we think, was kind of more associated with the earlier plate motions in volcanic belts similar to what we have in the Cascades today. Where we see the volcanism today along the Walker Lane, and exactly right, the Coso is actually right in the middle of the Walker Lane along and sort of a step in the Walker Lane where you would expect to see volcanism, almost like an incipient. I'm stretching this a little too far, but almost like an incipient spreading center. It's where the two major faults in the Walker Lane kind of step to the right relative to one another, and that helps to open up the crust. And where that happens, you commonly see volcanism. And so the Coso field is more of an indication of, I would say, the significant faulting activity along the Walker Lane today than it is of, let's say, an earlier weakening of the crust in that area.
I see. So, okay, let's go north now. We're on Highway 395, and one of the most spectacular parts of California. Hollywood loves it. The Alabama Hills there and Lone Pine and all the commercials and movies that have been shot out there. You've got Mount Whitney, you know, the highest point in California, towering off to your left as you're going north on 395, and Lone Pine there. And Lone Pine was the location of a very large earthquake in 1872. And does that earthquake fit into the Walker Lane hypothesis? Where does it fit in?
Yeah, it sure does fit into the Walker Lane, and that was an even larger earthquake, as you probably know, than the Ridgecrest earthquake. I think the estimates are about a 7.8 magnitude earthquake. So that was occurred on what's called the Owens Valley Fault, and had even more offset than the Ridgecrest earthquake. So that's again right, really smack in the middle of this belt of faulting that we call the Walker Lane, and yeah, just spectacular scenery and geology thanks to the Walker Lane and the tectonics of the region, the combined motion of sort of pulling the crust apart and sliding it side by side helps to generate these big mountains, helps to generate these long valleys, long deep valleys in between the large mountain ranges, and just creates spectacular scenery. And of course, that's punctuated here and there by these volcanoes, small volcanic centers like at Coso, and there's some cinder cones in the Lone Pine area, for example. Absolutely spectacular geology, and I agree, one of the best drives in California or the Western U.S. for that matter,
or anywhere on the planet, as far as I'm concerned, On our left, as we're driving north on 395, is this just towering wall of granite, the Sierra Nevada Range, which looks so very different on that side than from like the Sacramento Valley, San Joaquin Valley side, where it just kind of gradually works its way up to the crest. There you're just looking at this sheer wall, which it makes it so dramatic. I've seen in some of the literature and reading about this that there's this thing called the Sierra Nevada microplate. Could you explain to me what that is and how that fits in here?
Yeah, the Sierra Nevada microplate is the plate that lies between the San Andreas Fault and the Walker Lane. And so this is a big piece of crust. Highlighted, of course, by the High Sierra Nevada, and that crustal block is moving northward about 1 centimeter per year, and there's less earthquakes and deformation within the interior of the block. The deformation is focused on the west side, which is the San Andreas, and then the east side, which is the Walker Lane. And the Sierra Nevada are just really amazing, and they have a long history. And one reason you climb up gently from the east side, we think, is that is what's been called the gangplank at times to a much loftier mountain range that once existed in places like Nevada, but thanks to the Walker Lane and kind of the tearing part of the crust and both the side-by-side motion and the extending of the crust has sort of collapsed. And so we actually think that if we go back 30 million years or older before the San Andreas started to form, that much of Western North America looked more like the Andes, very, very high mountain ranges. And then once that plate boundary motion starts to change, you start to form the San Andreas, you start to rip those old, the mountain ranges we have today are amazing, but even higher mountain ranges, if we go back 30, 40 million, 50 million years ago, and those then start to collapse. And what that west side of the Sierras, as you slowly climb upward, is if you will the foothills to a much greater mountain range that since has collapsed across Eastern California and much of Nevada.
You know, as you explain all this, and as I imagine us traveling together up Highway 395, it occurs to me that the more you know, like somebody, for somebody like you, the more you understand all of these processes over these vast periods of time and projecting into the future, the more interesting these places are. I mean, they're beautiful scenery, and it's, oh, isn't that a beautiful mountain range and the snowy peaks, and wow, isn't that an amazingly dramatic valley there, the Owens Valley, and then the White Mountains on our right with the famous bristlecone pines, some of the oldest living things on Earth. But the more you understand this geological story, the more interesting it becomes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like I'm a kid in a candy store, if you will. There's just so many neat things. It's sometimes difficult to drive because you get caught up in the scenery. But I also tell people that it's hard to fall asleep, too, because the geology keeps me awake while I'm driving. There's just so many fascinating things, too.
So you're not going to fall asleep, but you might go off the road because you're looking at something.
There is that danger, yes.
I don't know if I think I want to take a tour of the Walker Lane with you, but I think I'll keep saying, can you, Jim, look at the road. Let's go farther north. North of Bishop is an amazing place. The Long Valley Caldera, is that where, how does that fit in with all this? Because that is one of the most amazing volcanic regions in California.
Yeah, it sure is. And, you know, the short answer to exactly why the Long Valley Caldera is there is we're not quite sure yet. It's a bit of a sort of a hot spot in the crust. There's a heat anomaly all the way into the upper mantle below the crust that's probably associated with the Walker Lane and these plate motions. If you drive up from Bishop, and you're driving up 395, you know that 395 jogs well to the west as you're driving north, and mm-hmm. and then you end up over at Mammoth and then head north from there. And the reason the highway jogs to the west is the high Sierras also kind of jog to the west there. So there's a bit of a break in the Sierras. The fault zones kind of step over, and we think there might be a little bit of pulling apart in that area, helping to accentuate the volcanic activity. But there's also some other things going on that there's various theories about, but some leftover heat in the mantle and so on from earlier tectonic events. But long story short is we're still a little mystified as to why exactly that Long Valley Caldera is there. At least I am.
Well, that's, you know, part of the fun is, like, if we understood everything, it would be kind of, I don't know, kind of boring. I like it when there are mysteries, when there's like, wow, that's, you know, that's a graduate student needs to work on that. Okay, let's continue north on Highway 395. Now we get to the Yosemite region on our left, and we're in Levine and Mono Lake, and there are volcanoes there too.
There are volcanoes there. And so now we start heading up along the east side of the Sierras, and we have a lot of faults that are helping to uplift the Sierras. But interestingly, in this area, we start to, the 395 diverges from this system of strike slip faults, which actually then steps to the east into Nevada. And over into the area around Hawthorne, Nevada, and a place called Walker Lake, which gave its name to the original sort of Walker Lane, if you will. And so we still have spectacular geology. We've got the volcanoes around Mono Lake. We've got the High Sierra to the west. We know, remember those satellite station, not satellite, but the GPS stations communicating to the satellites. We still know there's some of this side-by-side motion as we drive up 395 in that area, but the focus of that right lateral motion now moves off to the east into western Nevada.
I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Let's take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our look at the Walker Lane hypothesis with Nevada geologist Jim Folds. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's continue now with our visit with Nevada geologist Jim Folds as we examine the idea that the plate boundary between the North American and Pacific plates may be migrating gradually from the San Andreas Fault to the area east of the Sierra Nevada, the so-called Walker Lane. Let's continue north. Like, you are based in Reno, right? What's going on up there? You know, how? Because I know there's been a lot of seismicity going on in Reno. Does that have anything to do with this?
Yeah, it does. So we, as we drive up to Reno, and you know, and we keep the Sierras on our left, and then these lower but still some pretty major mountain ranges off to the right, in the Great Basin region, we have a lot of faults. Most of the faults, the motion would be predominantly vertical. But we know, based on those the GPS stations, that there's still some of this right lateral motion accommodated. Again, the main faults, the main strikes of faults, are off to the east of us in kind of west central Nevada, coming up through some small towns like Hawthorne, and then up to just the west. Just to the west of Fallon, near a small city called Fernley, up toward Pyramid Lake. But in the Reno area, we still have this motion. We had a series of earthquakes here in 2008 on the west side of Reno, and it was very, very carefully measured. And we know that in that sequence of earthquakes, which culminated, it was a swarm of earthquakes over about 3 months, culminated in about a 5.0 magnitude earthquake. We know that that entire sequence of earthquakes accommodated about 2 centimeters of this right lateral motion, and then also 2 centimeters of kind of up and down motion. So kind of nicely illustrating that combination of crustal motions in much of this region anyways.
You mentioned earlier that the Sierra Nevada themselves, there's not a lot of earthquake activity within them. But when we get to Lake Tahoe, my understanding is that changes. Is that right?
It sure does. Yeah, and what we actually see when we sort of look at the evolution of the Sierras through time is that it looks like the sort of earthquake activity and faulting seems to be sort of eating away at the Sierras through time, and cleaving off parts of it, if you will. So Lake Tahoe then is this interesting basin, a big basin. The bottom of Lake Tahoe is actually lower than the valley in Reno, for example. It's primarily a fault that we think has vertical motion, but also a component of this right lateral motion. And in fact, the big faults that bound Lake Tahoe are on the west side of Tahoe. We know those are active faults. There haven't been any, fortunately, major historic earthquakes in the Lake Tahoe area, but we know there's some pretty recent earthquakes that, for example, cut the glacial moraines that are only about 12,000 years old, which is geologically very young.
Yeah, that's young. And so would that be considered a geologic hazard zone for earthquakes then, the Tahoe region?
It is, yes. And Lake Tahoe straddles California and Nevada. So California Geological Survey has done some great work on the faults, as have others on the west side of Tahoe. And Nevada Bureau of Mines and Geology and other groups have, of course, done a lot of work on the faults that come up the east side of Tahoe. The main fault, though, is on the west side of Tahoe. And that actually, as you take that northward, that fault curves into one of the faults in the Walker Lane. As the Walker Lane kind of re-enters California north between Lake Tahoe and Susanville.
So, okay, now you're up in our neck of the woods here in Northern California where this show is produced. And my daughter is a geologist for the Modoc National Forest, and she lives and has a home in Susanville. Tell us about the northern part of the Walker Lane. And my understanding, and explain to me if I'm wrong about this, is that's kind of the youngest part of the Walker Lane. Is that right?
It is. And part of it is very young. So the really pronounced, conspicuous might be a better word, strikes of faults coming up through the Walker Lane in western Nevada, they come up through about the Honey Lake, Susanville area, and then they kind of, at least the big faults, more or less end. And then north of that, up through the Modoc Plateau, we have lots and lots of little faults. And we truly have the youngest part of the Walker Lane. So if I back up and we go back to Southern California, we know the Walker Lane starts forming about 10 million years ago or so. And up through, let's say, Bishop and Mono Lakes probably starts forming about 10 million years ago. Around Reno, it's probably starts forming about 4 or 5 million years ago. And in Northeast California, north of Susanville, it's just developing really today in the last maybe million years or two, or even possibly even less. And when fault zones are kind of developing, they are quite disorganized, and you have then lots of little faults. And you can fly over the Modoc Plateau if your eye is trained to catching the faults. Unfortunately, there's a lot of young volcanic rocks in the landscape below. You can see all of these little faults that are probably trying to become bigger faults, but the Walker Lane is just encroaching into that area. And so there hasn't been enough time to for the faults to sort of get organized and decide, if you will, where the strain is going to be concentrated, where that deformation is going to be concentrated.
You said earlier that the San Andreas Fault is about, 30 million years old?
Yep.
So is this kind of, for you as and geologist friends of yours, your colleagues, is this kind of like being able to observe, back in time, what it must have been like, what that could have looked like, in a way that you're getting to see the beginnings of this transformed boundary in its earliest stages?
Yeah. It really, the Walker Lane is one of the, I think, the best natural laboratories on Earth for understanding how major fault zones like the San Andreas, how they're formed, they're born and how they evolve into much larger fault zones through time. And so we can see some of this transition from south to north in the Walker Lane. And then, of course, we can relate it to the San Andreas and what, in a way, what the Walker Lane might aspire to several million years into the future.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I want to be clear that the Walker Lane is not going to turn into the San Andreas Fault System in any human lifespans, in generations to come. But could you, using your geologic, timefulness that you have, your ability to look at time in vast spans, what could things look like, say, 10, 20 million years from now if the Walker Lane really does become that new plate boundary, what would it look like?
Yeah, so if we looked at the evolution of the San Andreas through time and tracked that into the future and assume that things kind of continued to evolve at similar rates to what they have in the past, then the Walker Lane might be poised to become the plate boundary in 7 or 8 million years from now. That's obviously a very long time in terms of human timescales. And then kind of connect, if you will, kind of come up through Eastern California, Western Nevada, Northeast California, and then up into Southwest Oregon, and kind of head off the coast in Southern Oregon, Central Oregon area. And what we might envision then is that there would be sort of a series of major valleys, major basins in the landscape, similar to the Imperial Valley, Salt and Trough in Southern California, and the Death Valley region, et cetera. And then as that happens, then we might actually see the Gulf of California kind of progress northward up the east side of the Sierras. And maybe we have beachfront property in places like Reno 7 million years or so from now. Then if you want me to really look long term.
Go ahead.
Then we can picture much of Western North America kind of cleaving off and riding northward up toward Alaska. Because actually, once we get north of about Vancouver Island, there's another major fault called the Queen Charlotte Fault. Doesn't get too much attention because not too many people live there. But it's another big strike slip fault between the Pacific and North American plates. And eventually, the Queen Charlotte Fault will probably connect with the San Andreas Fault. And there'll be a big piece of crust off to the west that will be most of California, decent portion of Nevada, parts of Oregon, etc. And that will be riding north to Alaska. But now we're really talking tens of millions of years in the future. And it's easy for geologists. We work in sort of deep time all the time, excuse the pun. There is some societally relevant aspects of thinking about how things will evolve in the future.
Could you maybe talk about that a little bit? I know I'm a big fan of Marsha Bjornerud and her book, Timefulness.
Mm-hmm. Well, a key to understanding the future, geologic future, is, of course, the geologic past. And of course, there's lots of great studies on the San Andreas and the Walker Lane, and we're not the only group doing that work. I should mention lots of great groups, and we stand on the shoulders of many, many others. But there are some very socially relevant aspects of this, everything from understanding geologic hazards or earthquake hazards to understanding some of our natural resources. Some of our mineral deposits are associated with the faulting in the region. And then I think one very, very relevant aspect in today's world is geothermal energy, a major form of renewable energy. And we know that the geothermal activity that we have are fortunate to have a wealth of in much of Eastern California and much of Nevada is associated with these fault motions. And we can associate the geothermal activity with certain patterns of faulting and so on. So there really is a direct relevance to resolving some of our energy issues in developing new forms of renewable energy, thanks to all of this tectonic activity.
And before we let you go, because we're about out of time, tell us a bit about your work with the Nevada Bureau of Mines and Geology. What are you working on now? And I understand you really are interested in all of that hot water out there.
We are. And as we say, Nevada is always in hot water, but so is Eastern California, I might add. And so a lot of this research in, and let's say about the last several years, has evolved into really trying to understand how these faults help to control the locations of hot water. And one of the interesting aspects of geothermal energy is most of our resources are hidden at depth. We don't see hot springs or steam vents at the surface. And so we have to kind of understand the favorable sort of geologic situation to foster, I guess, geothermal activity. And so we've then started with characterizing where the known geothermal systems are, and that has led then to understanding where some of these hidden systems are. And that's where a lot of how a lot of our research has evolved at the Nevada Bureau of Mines and Geology. We serve as the State Geological Survey of Nevada, so our mission really is to assess geologic hazards and natural resources and do the basic sort of geologic studies to sort of protect the public, facilitate economic development with things such as geothermal energy and whatnot. So yeah, some of our research then has evolved into kind of the more pragmatic aspects of how we can relate the really interesting tectonics of the region to our natural resources.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your depth of knowledge about the Walker Lane. I've learned a lot more about it talking to you, and I enjoyed our tour up Eastern California, one of my favorite parts of the world. And we'll definitely be looking for more and more information. And when I'm over in that area, I'm going to think of myself as in the Walker Lane from now on.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much to our guest, Jim Faulds from the Nevada Bureau of Mines and Geology. And thank you for joining and supporting us here on Blue Dot. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.